researching the Mazzetti name, we discovered that the first triple somersault was performed by Mazzetti brothers. So that's...
And did you trace back to that you think...
No,
that really?
We can't find out where our great-grandfather came from.
Okay.
Yeah, he disappeared around the 1880s, and we don't know where he's from, where he's gone to, or where he came from, unfortunately. So,
but the Mazzetti name is such a very interesting name, you know.
If you broke it down, I think mezzo means half, and Etty is small, so it's not a big name.
in its pronunciation,
Mezzetti is the Mezzetti is the Italian pronunciation of it. Yeah. So yeah.
But you were obviously, you said that you were born in Dublin, so to have this name in Dublin back in we won't say what year.
Yes.
But can you imagine? I got to school and that was your name. That must have been interesting.
Yes, it had a lot of pluses because you were that little bit different. But also it had that sense of you didn't belong in some way, that you didn't quite fit in with the Murphys and Kellys. So there were all kinds of shortened versions of it. Spaghetti, you like the cement, the shoes, and things like that. Miss Farecki, so Miss Merchandise, were some of the names we were called, I was called. But I think there was that, there was the name, but there was also, my father was an artist and he was a master craftsman. So there was also that bit of art around the name and that sculptor, and you know, so it was a little bit different from, I think you mentioned earlier, the 9 to 5, you know.
Yeah.
While my father was a freelancer, but he would work at home a lot, so we were like his apprentices.
Was sculpting?
Sculptor. He worked on in RTE, he worked on the sets, he worked in film as well as doing gilding and sign writing, you know, anything in that kind of creative line. But because he did a lot of the work on trestle tables at home, we helped with the measuring out, striking the line, you know, the plumb lines, you snap it against the wall, you've... it's a special way with this chalk on it. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
Yes, yeah.
So you just chalk the line, and so when you snap it, it leaves this white line, so you don't have to rub out marks of pencils and so on. So some of those things we picked up as we were growing up, but I suppose that's getting away from the name Mazzetti.
No,
but they're part of, I think, where I'm coming from as an artist, because one of his jobs was a gilder, and so he gilded statues and, you know, so a lot of church work. And it meant that at the time, I don't know, these little gold books, do you know, they're a little orange, about 2 or 3 inches square. And so they were my drawing books from the time I was very small, when paper was just after the war. And so paper was scarce, so we had these, it's like little tracing books. And so I was constantly drawing. There were 6 of us. But I think I was the one that wanted to be like my daddy and follow that, you know, what he could do and so on.
Was he a big influence on you?
He was, yeah, and he would have taught us all, you know, we all went into some kind of art form. My nieces, grandnieces, they all have gone into some art form since, you know, so he has been an influence over all the families, you know, the extended family. So, yeah, I'm going to get a bit dry there. Can I have a...
Yeah. Obviously, you knew that you were different because you had a different second name and Francis is very strong first name. So, but you're a Dubliner. You said to me that you're from Dublin. So,
I'm from Dublin. Yeah.
Whereabouts?
I was born at the second lock, Grand Canal, just where the Lewis Line stops now. And so I was there for 7 years. But it was like the ideal playground, you know, the fishing, the swimming in the canal, watching the tugboats kind of filling, you know, as they came through the lock and all that. So literally outside our door where the Lewis Line stops now, Golden Bridge. So it was kind of a magical place. And then I think when I was, it was a cottage with a downstairs, so it's no upstairs. And then we moved in the early 50s to Marino, so it's the other side of the city. So I became a Northsider, and I've been a Northsider since.
Do you think being a Northsider is important? Is that do you feel that there's a difference from that part of the city then?
I loved Inchicore. I mean, that part of, you know, which I don't know that would be considered a Southsider as much, but I loved that place, a lot of early memories with it. And I think it greatly influenced my way of looking at life, because at the time, was St. Michael's Flats there, that was Keogh Square, it was an old army barracks, and a lot of people in very poor circumstances were living there. And we had to pass through that every day going to school. I went to Golden Bridge School. There was a lot of poverty around. So it's the way kind of you see life afterwards. You feel as a child, you know, that there's something about this that's not quite right. And, you know, so, you know, that we were just in a cottage, which wasn't a big step above, but we weren't among, you know, people who are really in desperate situations.
But you were living in this other world. You were an artist. Did you know at that stage as a young one that this was a different life and you could escape to it?
Well, now looking back, I would think that, you know, but at the time I was called a dreamer, you know, so spent a lot of my time on my own daydreaming. I think because there weren't other kids, my other siblings, they were a bit older than, you know, there was a 5-year gap, so there weren't too many around me, so I could do what I wanted and daydream. So I suppose, yeah, and I had time on my own. A Golden Bridge, yeah, it was a great name, and I often say, you know, that there was gold in my in my background, because my father being a gilder, but he used to do, he put gold lettering over the door, and it was called Coola Flake. My mother's from Avoca in Wicklow, so, and that's the area she was from, was Coola Flake, so it was in gold over the door, and and then moving to Marino.
But you had to move to school then, didn't you?
Moved school, yeah.
And did something click there when you moved to secondary school, say, in Dublin?
Well, that was still at primary school, and there was something very different about going to Marino, because it was a more established area. We were a huge, what they called a corporation estate that moved in, and big bulk of kids coming into a very settled community. It was difficult kind of to fit in initially. And then I suppose that became familiar. We lived just off Griffith Avenue, and then that became our habitat since my children, my grandchildren, they're all up and down the same road. So it has become like our familiar grounds. But it was different. It was difficult kind of settling in there initially.
We were so used to living in the other place.
Yeah.
And Marino's so like gentrified, isn't it? It's almost
in that part. Yeah.
Avenue is so beautiful. It's almost part of London or something of that way.
Well, that part, yeah. But we were in, yeah. When we moved there were fields and cows and all in the background. Okay. So it was very different for us, you know. It was like moving to the country, you know. Like it was our nearest thing was to Bluebell. We used to go up the canal on bikes up to Bluebell before we moved to Marino. So it was a different kind of.
Were you still drawing?
Yes, always drawing.
What were you drawing? What?
I think I went to drawing faces, cartoons, you know, fashion, generally flowers, anything that was around me. Until I think I was around gypsies. I used to love, you know, the idealized type of gypsy with a campfire and, you
freedom,
know,
yeah.
Freedom. And actually, that's, you mentioned Francis, that's the meaning of the word is freedom. One who seeks freedom. So I think I've spent my life seeking a free way of being. Yeah, but those are the kind of things that I was drawing until, I never did art in school, so it was, even in secondary school, I went to King's Inn Street. So that was, again, in the city centre. And yeah, it was just, you know, much. I left when I was 16. And
did you start working?
I was working for 2 years then.
At that, even before you'd left school, you were working, were you? No?
Yes, yeah. I worked during the summer. My sister was a confectioner and I worked in a bakery with her.
Oh, this is a whole other world. It's like cakes now. Let's talk about cake. I come from a huge family of confectioners.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Super Quinn, Buttercrust, all of those are famous. Massive family of original confectioners, handmade icing, all of that. Like, it's such a beautiful world.
Yes.
The smell on Sundays for our house.
Yes, yeah. I just loved it. I worked in Prendergast. I don't know, it was on Binns Bridge, I don't know if you knew it.
I absolutely know.
Yeah, in Rockers up in Phibsborough. There was a bakery there as well. I did two jobs. I worked in an office when I started when I was 16, and as well as on Saturdays, early morning, I'd work in the bakery for an hour, and then I'd go on to the office from 10 until 5.
There was always cake in the house, I can imagine.
There was cake. Yeah.
And biscuits.
And, well, actually, it was my mother was the cook at home, really. She was a great baker. And so I think, but my sister then was very particular in her icing, particularly wedding cakes, and you know, that very fine work of with the icing bag, and you didn't have all the tools that you have now, you know, it was handmade bags, and you know, so.
But you were still drawing. This is a different kind of drawing, but you were still creating, you were always.
Yeah.
Do you agree?
Yes, yeah, yeah. Well, moving, I think movement and drawing were both side by side for me, you know, so, and.
What do you mean by movement, as in form?
Dancing or, yeah. Yeah, but I could never really learn a set of steps. I didn't have enough discipline to, so it was all makey up, as they say. So now they would call it free flow, free style movement. But in my later years, I've been studying movement and studying my own movement vocabulary. And so that's where the performances have come into it. So I've studied for about 10 years. And that's really an interesting way of understanding, I suppose, where you're coming from, getting in touch with how you communicate to the world through movement, and how our bodies speak more than our words, really. So
quintessentially, that's it. You use yourself as a way of telling how you feel about the world and the story.
Yes, yeah. True.
And the first performance ever that you knew that this was the truth, that was what you wanted to do, can you remember? Can you describe it to us?
I was 50 when I went to art college, so I was late actually going to college. I went through sculpture, and I was fortunate enough to have tutors there that explored with me performance art, and I just wanted to do it. I felt it was such a release of, again, I suppose, breaking the rules, you know, that there wasn't one particular way of doing something, that it was an art form, that it had a solid base in, as a form of art, in a responding to the world and in creating an image using yourself or using your environment or working within that.
Did it help you? Do you remember we spoke earlier on about the being mindful and maybe from sometimes, I know this of myself, but I don't know if it's true of anybody else, but the days that you're down, that there's too much going on, that I would revert back to drawing or taking photographs. Do you see a correlation to in your life of maybe using that to fix the situation by being a creative?
Yeah, I think for me it's in movement. I think before it was through drawing, but then the drawing had to be more expressive, it had to be bigger and wider. I think I remember going to art class at night time and trying to copy a still life in front of me, and it was such a chore, it was so difficult. And then we had a break, and during the break at the class, I lashed out with the brush. And the tutor came over and he said, this is the way you need to be working. And so that, I think after that, I went to art college to find out what was it in a bigger, a freer expression. So I suppose when I'm down, when I'm, I think overwhelmed is the word more than kind of down. It's just the world, you know, there's too much going on, there's too much happening. And it's that sense I can't cope with this and I don't know where to park it to let me get on with having some kind of balance. So to actually move with or breathe in through it. So breathing is number one for me, breathing in through, well, what am I feeling now? So I write, I'm breathing. At the moment I can't sleep, you know, I feel something here, I feel pain there, and I'm breathing deeper now. So even as I talk about it, I'm conscious of my breath. Immediately I go back in. So from there I start to move and move in a way that I can find some kind of release. Where am I held here? Where is my body holding this tension? It's in my head. So if I stay in my head, it'll keep going round and round and I can't get any escape. So once I bring my attention to my feet, to movement, to how I'm sitting, my back against the chair, what's happening for me right now, then I become more grounded, I suppose to say. But it begins to have a sense. I can name things in the room. I see things I didn't see before. Before I would have been just all in here, just stuck here. That's why this little crease here. You know, but just so like this tensed up. And so the movement has helped me to open that up. In the performance art, you know, you're asking about that, how being a creative in that sense, I can get very wound up in my research. Go, you know, am I doing it right? Am I exploring this ethically? Is this, you know, all, what are the considerations? What am I seeing here? And sometimes I just have to walk through the space, walk in it, feel it, touch the walls, touch the space, and see what that's saying to me, rather than from here controlling my environment. Let the environment speak to me, see what the environment is saying, and then and then I'm sitting into the performance piece a lot easier, you know, so I can respond in the moment what's happening for me. Because I know all my experiences are within me. If I can remember that, it'd be great all the time. But as soon as it's like a catch hold of it, it's gone again, you know. So it's like a practice that you have to keep remembering and keep working with. And a great thing that I have, a great opportunity, is that I work with collaboratives and with collectives. So in that way, I have someone to bounce ideas off. I can talk with someone. So if I, and they know me now, they know I don't come from the conceptual, the idea space, I'll come to the felt place. And so if I move, then, you know, they understand where I'm coming from. So it's equally respected, I suppose, as an art form or as my way of working. I'm saying that because I think I didn't respect myself in that sense, you know. Because I can't come with the words, even though I'm talking, but to put it in art speak is very difficult for me. So for me to experience the movement first, and then afterwards I can talk about it. So for instance, I work with Pauline Cummins, and we've been doing a piece called Walking in the Way. And that's where we dress as men and we walk through the streets and we try to be, to not stand out, to be as invisible as we have come to know that some men are in the street, you know, and how is it to be in another person's shoes and how is it to be in men's shoes as they walk through the city. We've done that 10 times now in different cities, 8 different cities. So initially, what I'm saying is, initially I didn't know where this was going to go. I knew I wanted to do something around gender. I knew I wanted to explore how it was to be in someone else's shoes. What is it like to be a man walking around? Obviously, walking like my father was something as well that informed it, but it's also to get an understanding from other therapies I'm involved in. So,
why do you think that men are invisible as opposed to men and women being invisible?
I think invisible in a different way. In some ways, people pass by and they don't see men, and we had to do a fair bit of looking to look at men, to see how they stand, to see how they move. And this is real generalized, I know I'm doing that, but because we're of an age, so we were looking at men of our age, and how are they in a space? How much space do they take up as opposed to how women take up space? So we were looking at that as well. So all of these things have come after the initial, I just wonder what it's like. So walking in it, as we call it, walking in the way, it was suggesting that there is one way of walking, a patriarchal way, a system way. But it's that everything that's not that way is somehow different. And I think I'm probably just touching into my own difference as a woman. So it kind of goes back to my childhood as well, that difference. But some of the, I think as a woman, I've been used to being looked at, comments being made on my appearance, why don't you dye your hair, why don't you, you know, wear makeup, blah, blah. And how I am, what clothes you're wearing, they're nice, they're not nice, they're, you know, so I found that men, being a man, I could stand around, I could push out my belly as far as I could, stand back, lean against something, exaggerate a pose, spread my legs, kind of make my gestures much bigger. And there wasn't any sense for me of anyone paying any attention to that. Now, as a woman, my experience is different. I can't talk about every woman, but my experience is different, that I sit like this. You know, if I sit on the bus like that, you know, what's that saying?
Yeah.
You know, so it's, so we've been looking at that, and it has taken us, Pauline and myself, it's taken us into different places where we wouldn't ordinarily go. So we were invited to Madrid and we went to having a look around to see where we might perform, to find our route. We spent about an hour and a half to 2 hours doing this. And we went into a men's club where they're sitting at tables playing dominoes. And so our challenge was to pass off as men playing dominoes in this club, which we did, you know, and no one looked at us, but they looked at the art people that were following us as to what they were doing,
yeah.
Standing around looking. So in that way, I mean invisible, that...
Because my mother said this to me, that when you become older, you become invisible.
Yes. I think it's for women as well as men.
Which I think is quite sad in a way, you know? That you've worked so hard all your life to do what you want to do and then nobody notices. Would you agree with this or not? You wouldn't agree with it.
That nobody notices. I think in some way, yeah, the research and, you know, when I say research of your life's work, whatever you've worked at, whether you've been in an office or whatever, your experience of having whatever you've worked at, once you become a certain age, it's not recognised. It's about the young people, it's about the youth, and what's alive, what's kicking, what's modern is the focus. Through the media, through papers, through film, a lot of film is about young. Yeah.
So how do you cope with this idea that as you get older, you have to accept certain things? How do you get through your day?
Well, I think performance art is just a brilliant way of doing it, because I'm an older woman, and I make myself visible out there in an art scene as well as in performance art, as making statements about what I think about life, about my experiences in life.
And do you use this to help people, or is it purely for yourself, do you think?
Of course it's for myself as well, because I have something inside me that really needs to express itself. But what I have found is that younger people, and especially, you know, they come to 40, they think their life is over, you know. It's really sad. They think that, you know, that there's nothing left for them, you know, that they're past it. I've heard this and I can't believe it. So I'm encouraged to go and say, yes, come on, you know. So I've given some workshops to young people as well to encourage them to explore performance art and that, yeah.
You said to me that you're a workshopaholic.
I am a workshopaholic. I'm very interested in all aspects of healing. I'm a nurse. I still practice. I have done family constellations. I don't know if you know, that's where you stand in as a representative and work with your present day issues, but where they might be have a problem from the past. So the influence of the family, which may not be all you're doing, it may be a family thing that you've picked up. So family constellations is just an amazing process where a group of people and a facilitator will look at issues. So you're supporting other people and helping them to come to different perspectives on their backgrounds, as I have done in my own life. Movement. 10 years, I'm going next weekend, I'm going to Dorset for a peer group where we give workshops to each other. So there are 12 of us, we meet a few times a year.
And you're constantly learning as well, still.
Yeah.
Marvellous.
And then painting, free expression painting, that was another one. I'm a stress management consultant, if you ever need that.
Maybe, yeah. But not after this interview. Not after this. I'm very calm and happy. Lastly, what makes you happy? I know you've explained all of these things, but not so much the work end of things. Maybe I have a dog. and she's changed my life the last 2 years. So, you know, just being able to walk a dog. I mean, never had a dog in my life. Those little things that, you know, is it a cup of tea in the morning or...
What makes me happy is being with people. I just love being with people. A lot of my work, whether it's in real performance, as you would call it, but I do crochet on buses, and, you know, so someone will ask you and they'll tell you, they'll sit beside you, their granny did it. A woman from China sat in beside me. I knew she came from the back of the bus, so she had seen, she waited till the seat was free. And she sat beside me and insisted on showing me how it was done in China, which was brilliant. But I heard about China and their customs, and they have the same difficulties there with young people buying, you know, the ready-made, and the older people sitting in the marketplaces making the handmade things. And, you know, where's the market for it nowadays? And the skill is going, you know, so things like that. That makes me happy. My grandchildren make me happy. And they live next door, some of them.
What drives you mad?
A lot of things. I keep it under wraps. I think negativity really drives me totally. They're constantly trying... You know, when I meet these people that have negative views, and I know it's there are health issues involved in that, but I know there's also choice as to what you can, you know, when you can discuss things with you. So I suppose myself, what drives me mad about myself is that I hang back. I'm a procrastinator. I keep meaning to do things. I meant to prepare for this talk. And I ran into my studio trying to make a few notes. It's like, oh, I can't do this. So that really drives me mad, that I cannot stay. And, you know, so mad at myself for procrastinating so much and taking on too much to do, and bad drivers. I'm not a bad driver. I'm a brilliant driver.